Welcome to episode 15 of the Canuck Crosscast. Today we have genuine European cyclocross man, Gus Vandermeer.
Hello.
Did I get it? Gossa?
Yeah,
Gossa. Gossa Vandermeer. What am I saying? Rutjes.
What do we
to
say?
The podcast.
We say that at the end of the podcast.
Oh, that's the end of the podcast.
Yeah.
All right. So
welcome, and we're done now.
That's it. We're just out. Podcast over. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, quickest podcast I've ever done.
Goss is doing the America tour today. What, you came for Roanoke?
Yeah, came, I think it was the 12th of September or 14th of September, like mid-September somewhere.
Yep.
And I came without a flight back.
You live here now.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Eventually you end up in California surfing and never race a bike again. It's perfect.
Yeah, it can maybe go that way. Do a quick stop in Las Vegas to marry an American woman and, yeah, stay forever.
I like it. Why America? What made you come here? Why do you want to race cross here?
Well, I did, I think, 7 or 8 full-time seasons of cross in Europe. And, yeah, let's try it sometimes at the other side of the ocean. And, yeah, so there's awesome races over here. And, yeah, I raced almost in all the countries in Europe already. Tried almost all the races already there. And, yeah, instead of doing 3, 4, 5 times the same race in Europe, well, let's try to do another race, racing series one time.
So this is your first time racing in the U.S.?
I've been to the U.S. 2 years ago for a blog of mountain bike racing, but then it was on the West Coast.
First time racing cross.
Yeah.
All right, okay. You get 3 words. How would you describe American cross so far?
Fast, friendly, and dynamic racing.
Dynamic racing is 2 words, but we'll give it to you.
Without dynamic. The space bar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's second language. English is second language. Just mush it together.
It's friendly because you're hanging out with Canadians.
Yeah. Somehow we're traveling together for like the next 3 weeks now. Which, I don't know, we bonded over our Vanda last names and yeah. Yeah, it works.
Yeah, Mike actually sounds more Dutch than he really is, his name, but...
I know, I trick people.
I had to teach him how to pronounce his name right, so...
So how do you say? How is he supposed to say it?
Michael van den Ham.
You can say Michael.
Oh, I can say Michael. Okay.
Van den Ham.
Van den Ham.
Van den Ham.
Van den Ham.
Yeah,
we're doing good.
Okay, so you're channeling that, and that's why you've been going faster because you're channeling your Dutch speed.
I mean, I'm making enough power to explode things. That's for sure.
Yeah, I saw you spend some good time on the front the other day. At least photos indicated you were on the front.
I spent some good time on the front. So we just raced in Baltimore, which is like kind of all on the side of a hill. It's fairly hilly, lots of pedaling. The fields are still huge. There's like 70 people out there, and there's at least 10, 15, maybe more that are pedaling really, really hard and doing pretty good, especially on a course like Baltimore where there's like no discernible technical feature to split people up besides maybe the one-off camberway at the top.
Yeah, we rewatched the race, and like the first half of the race, like the first group were like 30 riders or so.
Yeah, little peloton.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
But yeah, going good, and then I broke a spoke on day one, and sometimes you can get away with that, right? It just like falls out and gets out of the way, and your wheel's a little bit out of true. But this spoke did its best to like eat my derailleur. We were going around, and I was like pedaling up the hill, and then Steven's behind me. He's like, dude, you broke a spoke. You should probably stop. I don't know if he used that many words, but pretty much along those lines.
And was it a really fast pit? So like you knew you're going to lose time going in?
Yeah, it was like at the top and I had to like stop and mess around with it for a little while and then ride probably for another couple minutes. Like I was able to ride it again, but I just lost, day one I probably lost like 15 seconds. And I almost got it back.
I saw that.
I almost got it back. But do you want to know what happened here?
I don't
know. Yeah, I'm here.
I almost got it back. I'm within 10 seconds. And then we watch the footage after, and you can see it. I get it within 10 seconds. And then this guy in this yellow and blue kit, this Dutch guy, Gossa, goes to the front and just is like, whoop, whoop, ramps it up right up to 20 seconds, and I'm out of the race.
I also try to win, but...
There's some bad blood between us.
Yeah. It's really silent in the van that we travel.
Yeah, like, I'm so mad. This is not good.
Yeah.
That's okay. You were trying to win. Because, what, you think the American riders aren't very good at trying to win, right?
No, yeah, I had a feeling like a lot of the riders just like let themselves drag to the finish line and then sprint instead of like, I think it's like being really hammered in with us in like the European racing style. Like you always try to win, even though like, you know, like, oh, maybe these guys are quicker than me. For example, like I was already quite sure I would never win that sprint if we turn in the last corner with like five people. So yeah, why not do all or nothing in the last lap? So I'd rather go for an all or nothing attack and become sixth, or do the all or nothing attack and like be on the podium instead of like, oh, stay in the group, let me drag to the finish line and get fourth.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, like, I kind of wonder if all the American, I agree with you, I think that's definitely the style of racing. And I always wonder, is like, they race like that maybe because like the World Cup selections aren't made yet? They're just trying to get as many points as possible.
Yeah.
Like, I'm selected, you're selected, we have nothing to lose, right? A couple points here or there, it doesn't really matter.
No. No, and I think on Sunday, almost the same thing happened to me. It was like, again, a really big group, but then there was quite of a split already pretty early. I think it was like 6-7 riders, and I was like in 10th wheel in the start because I was standing behind someone.
Yeah, oh, wait, were you behind me? Yeah. Payback. Payback.
Who messed up a start, so I was a little bit further in the field. And then like half the race, I was like also like 10-15 seconds behind the front group. Well, and they didn't go so fast all the time. Yeah, they were going really fast, but like they were just going too fast to close it up again. And I was riding alone all the time with two guys in my wheel. And I was actually looking around there like, hey, if we do like one fast lap, we all three of us are back in the main group, back in the mix to win that race. And they just don't want to ride. They just let themselves be brought to the slaughter bank and then they drop in the last lap. And I'm like,
just the slaughter pen.
Yeah, the slaughterhouse where they're very big animals in.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds gnarly. I mean, I think people, yeah, it's the case of they're just racing not to lose, but then they never actually stand to really gain something either. It's like you kind of settle in.
You're dead to lose, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. I like it.
Just gotta roll the cards.
You're ready to lose.
Yeah, I
totally agree. Someone was talking to me about before the race too, and very much about that. They're like, "Oh, like, do you think you could have?" I mean, this was before I broke spoke and kind of lost that group on Sunday. I tried to follow Vince Sebastian's, who ended up winning both days, and he did an attack. And they're like, "Oh, do you think you could have? You know, do you think trying to follow that attack was a good move?" I was like, "I don't know, but like, I definitely wasn't going to win if I didn't try to follow it."
Yeah, but if he won the race, it was always a good move to follow him.
Exactly,
right?
Like, if I didn't follow it, I was going to get at best second. If you follow it, who knows?
You might be in a shot to win.
Maybe he crashes. Maybe he cracks a little bit. Maybe he flats. Like, there's so much stuff that can go wrong.
Maybe he's not a good sprinter.
Yeah, maybe he can't sprint. I mean, evidence of the last 2 weekends, he's clearly just like a little better than everybody else.
But you never know, huh?
Yeah.
Maybe this spins into our question, right? We got a question from someone.
Oh.
Yeah. So it was from Meg. So Meg's friend from Lantern Rouge. And it was just about, I mean, it's good that we have you here because it's about Euros coming over to race these. Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's about coming over like for the pre-World Cup races. And they just wanted to know, like, how often do Euros come over for these early season races? Like, to scoop, basically to seemingly scoop points because Vincent Bastian's is one. He's 4 out of 4.
Yeah, yep. I think it's like also, don't want to say easy to scoop points in Europe, but you can be in the mix for the same points with a lot less cost. So I think that's why you see like not many Euros go over to the US because, yeah, we have so much UCI race in the beginning of the season. Also, if you, for example, go to, I think last weekend it was a double weekend in Norway. Well, if you take the effort to drive to Norway, you're pretty sure to be on the podium both two races. Well, if you're a bit on a decent level and need points. Mm-hmm. And then you only lose one weekend. And if you would go to the US, well, cost a lot of money. And you have the big jet lags and everything. So you doesn't necessarily get too much better of it. And yeah, I just went over because I decided to do the entire season here. So it's kind of like worth the cost of the plane tickets a bit more. And it's, for me, also one giant adventure, big road trip. And just get all the races in. And I think if you really need the points, and yeah, of course, all your sponsors are from Europe, or you need to be good there with your team, then it's better just to like gather the points in Europe a bit and see like, hey, let's take one long drive to Scandinavia or look at some smaller race in France or Slovakia and get the points there.
Right. And so yeah, you're saying it doesn't really like Vincent Bastian's came here, and he's getting some points, but he also, like I was talking to him on the start line a little bit too, he also likes racing here. He has family in Florida. He has some connections.
Also really close to the World Cups, his aunt lives.
Okay, yeah, his aunt lives close to the World Cups. You're coming because you won different races, so it's like, you guys aren't really coming just for points. It doesn't,
no,
doesn't really make sense too much.
Yeah, it's like, it wraps up like the whole experience. Like, if you're doing the World Cups as well, it's like different than just coming over to do a couple UCI weekends. And yeah, there's so much racing. Like, I think we, as North Americans, we think of European cyclocross as Belgium, Netherlands. Like, that's it. But there's so much, like, everywhere else. Like, over, like, you know, kind of, like, farther east, there's a ton of racing. And Scandinavia a bit, too.
And a guy like Bastian's could be winning C2s in France, too, right?
Yeah.
He could be winning, he'd win those races in Norway.
Yeah, really easy. Like, easier than here, huh?
Yeah.
Like, the weekend before he flew in here, he got second in a C2 in France. Well, so he already had quite some points, of course. And yeah, now he's, I think, after winning this weekend now, double, he's fifth now in the new UCI ranking.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, and before that, his highest ranking was, I think it was 17 that he set. Something like that. So it's his highest UCI ranking ever. Of course, he has like a good start of the season with only 4 wins and 1 second, so then you'll rack up points.
And the points total pretty much went to zero, right? So,
yeah.
Like, just the world champs points. But he was saying, which I thought was interesting, that I think he's racing the World Cups now, but there was a while when the Belgian Federation did not want to send him to the World Cups because he's too old, they said. Yeah, not, you know.
I'm a bit in the same boat, so.
Yeah, Dutch Federation doesn't want to send you. You're not the... What did they tell you? You're not serious enough?
Oh yeah, they told me I didn't show enough motivation anymore to be a world-class rider, because I raced a lot of the races in France and Switzerland and the Czech Republic instead of being dragged to the slaughterhouse in Belgium every weekend for place 15 to 25, you know? Like, then I also train 20, 25 hours a week normally, like pre-season up to it. Then I rather like race for the prizes on like the second pro level than just to be filling up the peloton in Belgium.
Well, and it's way better for your partners. Like, it's way better for you know, your bomb track, for Hunt, for me, for Giant, for Easton, to be racing at the front of like these races that are on GCN and Eurosport, or racing for the podium and somewhere in France, than it is to be like 25th at a super prestige where nobody ever sees you.
Yeah, you have to use a binocular on the first 3 seconds, and then you're only in the screen there.
Unless you crash into the inflatable barriers,
then
you make the coverage.
You have to do something crazy.
Yeah,
I'll
just
take 40 people down in the start, but
yeah, be in the crash game. Yeah, I mean, especially for, like you said, those of us on smaller teams, like the racers on the big teams, they have the support to go to the big races, so even if they're finishing 20th, they still have the same support. But if you're running a smaller program, like, resources makes more sense to actually
To be honest, I think that's something a lot of people from outside of Europe think that's the case, but it's not really the case. So once you sign for also a bigger team in Belgium or whatever, like if you sign for Fidea or if you sign for Paulshausen or whatever, like the rider has the contract. So basically you just show up to the service course, you get all your bikes, get your kit, you get your salary every month. Well, depends on the ranking of your contract. Some get a camper from the team, others they have to cut a part of the salary to pay for the campers, others the parents have to take an extra loan on the house to buy a camper or whatever. And then it's their parents often stand in the tech zone. It's only very small teams who have like, maybe they have like one or two head mechanics, and they stand in the tech zone for a few riders. For example, at Alpecin, they have like a few head mechanics that normally they're in the summer they go with the road team. They just gave them a contract the entire year. And they said like, yeah, in the summer you have to go with the road team. And in the winter, because they paid them the entire year, you have to go to the cross races. So only a few of the Alpecin team, they have like the set mechanics in the tech zone. And all the rest is just like dad's, uncle's friends who stand in the tech zone. And of course, and you have guys and they have like big contracts, like a few hundred thousand euros a year. Like they have their mechanics on the payroll, but the mechanics being paid by the rider themselves. For example, Lars van der Haar used to have the same mechanic for many years. Really, really, really good mechanic. He's now with Lotto Jumbo. And Lars just made sure like, hey, he has all the time to the entire season go with me. So he worked half a year in a bike shop, just normally in a bike shop, and then half a year he was working for Lars. And that's how it often goes. And especially if you run a private day program, in that sense it's not really different. The only thing is, well, I cannot pay my mechanic or whatever, so I'm already happy, he always wants to go. But it's really like it's always parents and uncles or dads who are standing in the tech zone. So yeah, that's a thing I also hear a lot here in the US. Like, hey, we all want to go to Belgium, like we want to go this and this, but the teams don't contract your helpers, and they give you a contract, they pay you as a rider, and you have to figure out the rest. So that's why also a lot of European riders don't come to the US for the World Cups, because everybody has to pay themselves, huh? And it costs a shit ton of money.
Right, so you're saying basically the rider just has their contract, and if they want a fancier RV, they rent more, they pay more money for the fancier RV a lot of times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of cool, because, you know, I definitely feel like I have this illusion that they just show up and they have these, like, super, like, huge setups, but it is just on the riders kind of making it happen themselves.
Is there one place, like, Telenet, I guess not Telenet, Balawaz always has those great photos where they're, like, touching their butt and looking over their shoulder? Does the same person take all those photos and wrap all the RVs?
Oh, yeah, that's just a photo shoot at the start of the season.
It's amazing.
And then, yeah, then all the RVs go to the wrapping companies. And
we make fun of that photo all the time. It's like looking over your shoulder, like, oh.
Yeah, but that's the best way to have all your sponsors in the shot. Huh?
It's my favorite one. If I ever had a Euro RV, maybe even a North American one, I want the, like, looking over the shoulder.
Well, you should get the stickers made here, or like being sticker like this magnetic stuff, and then get the rent an RV or a minivan in Europe, and put the magnet on there.
Yeah, you got to work that into your budget.
Yeah. big life-sized.
It's really important, because then everybody also flashes the lights or honks at you at the highway, because they know, like, hey.
Okay, this is what I've always wondered. We always in Europe have like some ratty looking Canada vans or a ratty looking different van. Would I get better parking?
You mean the white one?
We have new vans now.
Yeah, the white one that almost falls apart.
Yeah, okay.
We have new ones now. They got new ones.
Oh, do they look nice? Are they wrapped?
No, but they got new ones. They're working on it.
They look nicer. Would we get better parking spots if I had a little RV with some stickers and my looking over my back?
100%.
Or they'd send you really far away.
No, probably not.
Only if you were an elite Vrouwen, they'd send you really far away.
Yeah. That's also, that's maybe a pro tip. Like, so I've been, since I'm first year under 23 rider, I've been always saying that I'm an elite rider.
Yeah.
Because then you can always, they always let you drive to the elite parking. So from the under 23s, I was like, I'm elite. I was just always really early for the elite races, but I'm an elite. So you never had to park like crazy far away.
You never want to be a...
Belofton.
Never want to be a Belofton.
No. So if I rock up to a race, I should say I'm bringing the vehicle for my elite male teammate, so I can
For example,
I'm staff.
You're the swan. You're the mechanic. Yeah, they might not believe you're the mechanic. I don't know if they have any women mechanic really in Belgium.
No. So
that might be a stretch. Yeah.
Yeah, just make it look a little bit bigger. But that's also a thing, like, if you rock up to, like, a smaller race in Belgium, like a non-UCI race, you will be flabbergasted with the amount of campers who stand there, especially, and the level of campers. Like, they're all huge, brand new, crazy expensive, and they're all owned by the bank. So, like, just parents taking an extra loan for the kids to buy a camper to go to the races, and then just for the local races, I did one local race in Belgium once, and I was literally flabbergasted by the amount of campers and the new campers. Then, if you come then to the UCI race, then everybody has sketchy campers.
At the local races, all the kids should have, like, on their jerseys, that their sponsors just should be, like, mom and dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, who's your title sponsor? Mom and dad.
Oh, man, and they have expensive equipment and everything. It's, like, insane.
That's here, too, right?
We were
talking about this. There's that Olympic Development Academy, and they're paying, like...
A lot of money,
$15,000 or whatever, to race for it and race in a little like inverse of the American jersey.
And they don't even get the bikes. Like everybody just rides their own bikes and everything. They just ride the same kit. They do course practice together and they're warming up under a tent together. As far as I'm just from the sideline. I heard also that they do some training camps, and I assume there's some good guidance for those kids as well. But yeah. like this whole like pay to race thing, like especially for the kids on that age, that's not really so much a thing in Europe. Well, sometimes on the higher levels it happens, or like sometimes also like foreign riders that like dream big of racing in Belgium, like, yeah, money makes the world go round, so if you bring some you can race. But that's yeah, with the kids here in the US, once I also heard like the amount of money they were talking about, I was like, oh good, that's a lot of money. But like setups here in the US are like insane already, and we talked about that.
It's like there's some, it's like a competition right now. There's like the Alpha team has this full like semi-permanent structure thing that they put up every time.
They've got Fort Knox this year.
And Comp Edge Racing has like 8 tents going on.
Yeah.
The Cannondale one is like not that big relative. They have the biggest truck.
Yeah, they have like the big truck that like pulls out on the side with the big tents, and they only have 3 riders. Huh? It's only Curtis and those two women.
Yeah, Clara and Katie.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what else is pretty big? Stephen Tilford Foundation is pretty medium-sized.
Yeah, for the riders they have.
Yeah, yeah.
They have like two or three big camper vans.
And oh, right. They have 2 4x4 sprinters. That's pretty out of control. Yeah,
they're pretty
You
sick.
Definitely need those to go to the race. Oh, and then there's us traveling in the jam van, which is like the rattiest sprinter known to mankind, with 2 tents.
The old tents from Jeremy Power. So they all say like J Power and all that stuff.
We're high class over here.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's the other team? Oh, the Pony Shop team, which is not a very big team, but they're rolling around in like an old Astro van or something with 1 tent.
Yeah, yeah.
There are partners. Yeah.
If we wrap up with the Jam Fund to the race, because I'm traveling with the Jam Fund team and also Michael now, and that van just comes up and I don't want to talk down the van, but like my experience so far is it's sometimes a surprise if you make it to the race or not.
And put it this way, they were in Baltimore, there were multiple people that got things stolen from their vehicles, but nobody went close to the jam van.
No.
It's like a big like, there's nothing valuable in here, let's be real.
Yeah, and that van just rocks up, and then you're like, oh well, that's good size van, no problem at all. And then like within 5 minutes, the van explodes, and there's like stuff all around it. Like there's in this circle around the van, like there's wheels everywhere. It's always like this giant puzzle because they have like 1 million different wheel bags, or they have all the same, but everybody puts their wheels every time like in random bags. So then like, how many wheels are like in that van like last weekend?
Oh, probably 40.
Yeah, 40.
Like, I'm not even an exaggeration.
And then so everybody one by one starts looking their own wheels through all those bags. And then you have to separate your own again from the other ones. And then after the race, well, all the wheels go in a random wheel bag because they're laying around everywhere. You just, oh, here's another wheel bag. Let me put a wheel there. Here's another wheel bag. Let me put a wheel in there.
It'll be a test. Now that it's just the two of us and Avery, how much more organized can we be?
Yeah.
Than that. Because maybe we won't be any more organized at all. And it'll just be like, a Goss Michael explosion.
Yeah, but at first, like, only Michael and I are riding the red challenge tires. So they were, like, a bit easier to pull out. Like, oh, you only put the look at the color of the tire. And you're like, hey, that could be mine. But also, yeah, my Hunt wheel bags also ended up in Canadian hands already.
I appropriated them.
Michael, Michael, as far as food goes, I guess this applies for equipment. He's an opportunivore. He just kind of...
Oh, he just eats everything that's around?
Oh, yeah. Opportunivore.
Okay, oh.
Yeah, it's a term I stole from a teammate a few years ago, and I was like, yeah, that applies.
So, you guys...
It's gonna come when you're on a road trip.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You always have to, like, keep something behind, like...
Yeah.
I can get pretty grumpy if I don't get, like, enough food or in time, and... Especially like if you're traveling in a van, like then they can get on the nerves a little bit. So I have to fuel myself also, like to keep the vibe up a little bit in the van, you know.
Yeah. Well, what's the on that note? What's the best American food you've had so far? Are you Chipotle or what's your what's your favorite?
Okay. Well, I don't know how many American or Canadian listeners you have, but this might shock the world. Oh, I can shock the world on very few like American things, but so 2 years ago I went first time to America to race mountain bikes. Maybe side note, I'm from the dead countryside in the Netherlands, middle of the cows.
Middle of the cows.
I never had a burrito in my life. then they gave me my first burrito. And I was like, okay, this is heaven. Also, like, yeah, food in America cannot always be that healthy, or like making your own food can be pretty expensive. So I was like eating burritos every other day. Now on this trip, I'm being introduced in the Chipotle. Mm-hmm. I never knew what Chipotle was until here. And then I think the first trip straight away to Roanoke, where the van broke down, was carnage everywhere. We made it to the race, it was all fun, all awesome that it worked out. I think I ate Chipotle 3 or 4 times in 2 days.
Where else did you guys go, though? This was the new one for you, when the van broke down at the hotel.
Oh, yeah. So we went to the Hooters. Yeah. But that was, I had really good experience in the US with all the people being really nice, except for the, like, the people who middle finger me when they're driving a car. But like people from cycling, they're really nice. Like we drove here to Baltimore with a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend in a big truck. I'd never been in a big truck, and it was really, really cool.
Yeah, yeah, it was like a jacked up Toyota Tundra.
But I also had like some less cooler things, like, well, so the van broke down. We stayed in this hotel in this like sketchy area around New Jersey somewhere. I don't know. Next to this hotel, like in the same building, there was a Hooters. Well, and the thing that happens then in a van, if you're traveling with only dudes in such a van, like the Hooters is like being like hyped up. So I'm like, okay, I just fuck this race. I just want to go to the Hooters. Like they've been hyping it up so much. I was like, this is perfect. Like the concept to understand was a bit weird, because like, yeah, in Europe you would never be able to have this. Like, oh yeah, we just have this bar that plays sports restaurant with chicks and like short clothes, big boobs, bring clothes around. Like, oh, that's a good place, let's do this. And I was like, oh well, this might sound pretty good. So like they've been hyping it up for 3 days straight. In the end, like we end up in the Hooters Monday morning, 3 o'clock, and yeah, all the others, they just saw the disappointment in my eyes. That is like, so, yeah, and I was like, yeah. I don't want to like body shame anyone, but yeah, I was like, so the whole like thing they talked about, and also the pictures they showed me and everything from the Hooters, they were like not as cool as the Hooters on a Monday afternoon, 1 o'clock, but maybe I have to try again on a Friday evening or so.
I don't know. I don't know if Hooters is cool anymore at all. I think it's, or ever was, I don't know. Might have. I don't know.
And I still want to go to the Taco Bell. I've never been to the Taco Bell.
Oh, yeah.
I want to go to the Taco Bell. And I still have to drink Mountain Dew.
Yeah, you went to Bass Pro Shop, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Okay, so I also Bass Pro Shop. I was really hyped up to go to Bass Pro Shop. And was like, oh, yeah, we'll go to the Bass Pro Shop on the way to this and this race. But, yeah, I know, like, I could maybe, like, so they told me, like, oh, this is a giant outdoor show, and they have, like, swimming pools inside where there's, like, boats in the swimming pool.
Really? Where did you see that?
I don't know. They told me, like, and it's the size of a football stadium. So, yeah. So I was like, oh, this is the biggest outdoor show I will ever go to in my life. Because, yeah, for us, like, in America, everything is big. So I was like, yeah, then if there's a swimming pool with fishing boats in it to sell fishing boats, well, could be true. So to save some time and not be hours in that store, I checked already on the website the stuff that I wanted to have. So I could, like, a bit more straightforward, like, go to those aisles. So I checked all the stuff on the website. I was like, oh, I want this, this, and this, this. We stop at the Bass Pro Store, because I checked all the Bass Pro Stores in the U.S. and the route we were driving. So I was like, oh, we passed this Bass Pro Store and this one. So we went to the Bass Pro Store, and it was really tiny, and all the stuff I checked on the internet, they didn't have.
So it sounds like you've been let down a couple times by America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have. Are there any other big stores on the bucket list that you have to go to?
Yeah, maybe want to go to like the giantest Walmart ever.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, when you're down in Fayetteville, Walmart is based out of Bentonville, so like you're going.
I want to go to Vegas going, and Walmart.
Yeah, yeah.
And drink
Mountain Dew. You can go to like the Walmart Museum.
And drink Mountain Dew. So they don't have Mountain Dew in Europe, right?
Maybe I've seen it once, like, but yeah. Here's like they have this giant 2-liter Mountain Dew once. I was like, either way, you get a heart attack if you're on the bottom of the bottle, or yeah, as you said, you just piss green for like the next month.
Radioactive green.
Remember
your last time North Carolina, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You should have the entire 2-liter of Mountain Dew and see how you go.
I'll probably be pretty rinsed out. It's like I've done 23 UCI races.
You'll be sweating green.
Double every week, just Mountain Dew all over.
Yeah.
That'd be great. Remember the last time we were in Fayetteville? We went to, there's that Brahms. So I think you should take them to Brahms.
Oh, yeah. We'll go to Brahms.
Yeah.
I think.
I just.
I have, apparently we should adjust our, like, when we went to Fayetteville, apparently we were racing in what is now the parking lot. So it's changed a little bit since then. So this course that 2 years ago, we were like, this might be the worst cyclocross course I've ever ridden in my life, has been vastly improved.
Yeah, well, I mean, we saw for the mountain bike race they had there, it looked like it was legit. Like, they kind of Olympified it and added a ton of features. So much work. Like, they had the infrastructure to do it. So, but yeah, that was hands down one of the least pleasant race experiences I've ever had up on that hot, sticky grass field.
Well, maybe that's good to know before I'm leaving there.
Yeah, it's much, I think it's better now, but it was maybe one of the best leaving the race experiences I've ever had. We were like pulling the trailer.
Okay, now give some context. So, like, on the Saturday, started on Saturday with the conditions Saturday.
Saturday was dry and bumpy. And it looked like it hadn't rained in 100 years in Fayetteville. And then it just, like, it rained so hard on Saturday night and Sunday. It was like, you know when it rains hard enough that the water's, like, bouncing off the ground and you can see the drops, like, a foot in the air again? That's what it seemed like. And this entire mountain turned into, like, a giant mud puddle, but we already had our tents and our trailer and everything already parked up there. So it's like we had to get in. They weren't letting people drive up the mountain because the road was too slippery and, like, the parking lot was too crazy. So I think we all, like, walked up the mountain to start. And then the end of the race, which was totally muddy, we're parked out in the middle of this field and, like, the truck has to go get the trailer somehow.
We were at the farthest end of the field, too. Like, we were way back over there.
And so we, like, the truck gets there, hooks up to the trailer, and we're just like, I have no idea if we're going to make this. And Dylan, like, hops in the truck and is what, he's probably just, he had the thing, like, pinned, there's no stopping. And he's sitting there, he's like, if we make this, I'm going to shit my pants. And I have it on video. It's, like, the most amazing thing. And we made it. Yeah. Somehow.
And then, yeah, but, like, other vehicles, like, the guy, it was just like the, I'm going to shit my pants if we make it out of here. And then somehow,
driving around with a tractor who was, like, pulling people out left, right, and center.
Yeah, that's really normal in Europe. At the, like, in December at the cross race, yeah, like, in Switzerland or Czech Republic. Like, okay, so they organize a race, make a course, organize showers. And you also have to organize a tractor to pull all the campers out again. Yeah, it's like every season, like, and, like, on average, you can push a camper out with around, like, 8 to 10 people.
Hmm.
And, yeah, I've seen that happen before. Last year in Tabor, we pushed out, like, 4 campers or whatever.
So do you get the fans to push out the campers with you, or do you get riders to push them
out? Yeah, riders push each other.
Oh, okay. So if you were to pick one team to push your camper, who's the strongest? Is it Balawaza Trek? Is it, like, who would be the best pushers?
So I think Balawaza Trek also has an agreement with the camper company they have, but over the years, I've seen those wrapped sailor net Balawaza campers being stuck in mud pretty often.
Stuck more often.
So I'm not sure if they rent them out with winter tires or with, like, good equipment, but they're stuck pretty
often. I feel like, maybe, like,
maybe they're not the best drivers, eh? That's also possible.
With Powell Sassen, you get Lauren Sweek to help push you up, but you also are taking on Michael Vanternout and Elie Zerbed, and I don't feel like they have the size to be good camper pushers.
No. We pushed Stone Art out once, and I was like, dude, you're, like, the best pusher yourself. And I'm pushing you out of there.
I bet you Woke could just do it by himself, one-handed.
He just pulls it out. He's he just pulls it out.
Yeah. We got really sidetracked.
No, this is totally on topic. You just got to be prepared because, I mean, their last time in Trek, it was a deluge. But the parking there is on asphalt. You get a parking.
Yeah, we have good parking. I got the email confirmation today. P2 athlete parking paved.
Oh yeah. I also got some PDF file about the race.
We're set for all those parking spots. So yeah, I guess that's where we're off to next. We're in Pittsburgh right now, Gus and I.
Yeah.
Avery is driving with the van to meet us tonight. And then tomorrow we're driving to our Airbnb in Waterloo, or just outside of Waterloo. We're both going to race Friday, race Sunday, drive to Iowa City, stay the night, and then drive the 8 hours to Fayetteville on Monday. It's a lot of van time. But we looked at this. Originally I was going to fly to Fayetteville, and it was like, you could fly, and it's a flight with a connection, total time 6 hours. And you have to get to the airport early and all this stuff. Or you could drive. And you have to rent a car for $600. Or you could drive and it's 8 hours. And it's like, well, I guess we'll just drive.
Yeah, honestly, like sometimes just staying in the vehicle is so simple.
You don't have to worry about your equipment. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff.
Also, at the race, you have all the stuff.
Well, tents and all the things. So, but we're kind of going into a pretty, like, if we both race Friday, Sunday, Wednesday,
Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
We're looking at like six races in probably what, 9 days or something like that.
Yeah, and a lot of driving. Guys,
like that meme said, it's like the cursed period. Only all the drives are. They said four times as far, but they're actually eight times as far.
Yeah,
like the cursed period, but all the drives are eight times as far.
So you guys are going to do all three races in Iowa?
We'll see. This weekend, I was always saying if I was in the running for the series, like for a good result in the USCX series, I would do all three. This weekend, kind of, I broke two chains on Sunday and I broke the spoke on Saturday. I'm not really in the running anymore. Two chains.
We're going to have to edit in some two chains audio for the intro outro now.
Two chains intro music. So yeah, I broke the one chain off the start line and then I had a nice little run for a while. And was like, I think I got my bike, I don't know, between 30 and 45 seconds behind the last place rider. And I was like, okay. Curtis did this the day before. And that was actually in my head because Curtis broke a chain off the start line on Saturday.
When I stood behind him?
Yeah, you whoever goes stands behind breaks a chain. He's bad luck for himself.
I stare at the chain.
Except you don't want it to break. But it was actually my fault that I broke the chain because before the race, I lined up beside Carrie. And we were talking and I forget who brought it up, but Carrie was like, oh, someone needs to like stack it up so Blevins can't get to the front. And I was like, yeah, Curtis did it for us yesterday when he broke his chain. Someone else should do that. And then I broke the chain. So it's like I karma'd myself into it.
That's no good.
I was like chasing in my whole, I was like, I knew Curtis had made it up to ninth the day before with a broken chain. So I was like, screw it. I'm competing against Curtis today. See if I can make it up to ninth.
Yeah.
And I think I was like in 10th or 11th, and then I broke the second chain. And
I wasn't pulling this time, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
You were trying to hold it up.
I got the speed down.
No, you were in like 7th trying to chase it back.
Yeah, but I was also keeping the speed down there.
You were like yelling at the guys?
Yeah, like,
yeah.
Hey,
you were throwing things across
the
course
of them?
Yeah, I was
like, rustig.
Oh, what's that mean?
Slow down.
Okay.
But I didn't understand it.
They don't speak Dutch, yeah.
No, I was not.
Oh, yeah. The second chain... I broke my chain and my spirits.
It was a spirit chain.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's super odd that you broke two. Like, have you guys... were they new chains or were they used chains? They're just...
And training. It's like they just... It's... We put new chains on, new master links, all of the things. What's... I don't know. It kind of feels like... It was just one of those weekends, you know? Sometimes the best stuff happens. I can't even figure out...
You had three things go wrong.
So I'm hoping that this is just like, you know, everyone has like an allotted amount of mechanicals for the season.
Mm-hmm.
Mine just happened one weekend. It would have been better if it was a weekend where I had like terrible, terrible form, but you know, whatever.
Yeah. Have you guys looked at the start list for the World Cups yet? I mostly looked at the women's one, and it is not a soft World Cup yet.
No? Like we're all talking about what it would be?
Well, you kind of like think, oh, the American races, sometimes they're not quite as well attended by some of the bigger European teams. But let me just pull it up here. The Dutch women's team is full. They, Lucinda Brand, Denise Betsema, Anne-Marie Wurst, Yara Kasteleijn, Fenn Van Ampel, Anique Van Alphen, Marianne Vos, Inge van der Heijden, Puck Peters, Manon Bakker, and Shirin... and Maud Kapthans. So that's literally everybody.
There you have your top 10.
Here, I can tell you. Here, the men's one has five Dutch riders, eight Belgians, at least, maybe more. Yeah, this is not a soft World Cup. There's...
No disrespect, though, but the women's field is more stacked.
Yeah, we're missing the Wouts. We have no Wout in Matthew. You have everyone in the women.
Yeah, Yolanda, like Yolanda's here. Evie's here. Like both the Clausels from France are there. It's like, and I saw that, and I saw like how fast the racing was even this past weekend. I'm like,
but why are you not here?
I'm tired.
Yeah.
Gotta take breaks every now and then.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The women's field has everyone. Like, the men's field is missing Welton Matthew and Tom Pitcock. So that kind of changes the flavor of the race a lot.
But it has us.
That's right. Right here. Ranked. UCI ranked 56 in the world. Gus Vandermeer.
Start number 6 in the World Cup. There we go.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, I don't think that's where you get to line up. That's just your number.
Take it.
I always have like really good numbers in the World Cups because the Netherlands is so highly ranked, and then I'm like with this really low number. Like I've been standing like fifth row with like number 6 on my shoulder.
And here I'm gonna be 43, number 43. Yeah.
That's cool though. You get the sweet numbers. You just get to line up. But even still, you guys would probably be getting decent call ups.
I think so. I mean, there's a lot of people. Like, I'm ranked 38th right now.
Yeah, but you probably get, maybe a third row, second, third row call-up?
Something like that. I mean, the World Cup ranking, you just have to get a top 24, and then you get to have a better call-up for the next couple.
Yeah, but even right, this first World Cup is just based on UCI ranking, and you guys have all been rolling good points, so.
I mean, the Swiss only come with one, and one dude I've never heard of.
Mateo. Oh yeah, that's a U23 guy. He actually lives in Canada. Mateo Apizzo. He's been living in Quebec for a while, and he's their Swiss guy.
Oh, he just has a Swiss passport.
Yeah.
Who is this guy? Felipe Tomateo Nistrom Spencer.
From where?
From CRC.
What's
country CRC?
Croatia. No, that'd be CRO.
He is from 1983. How old are you then?
9 years older than me. 38. Anyways, there's a decent World Cup field. It's a few riders smaller than it was in 2019, but I think that's partly because the U.S. isn't getting their super bonus spots anymore. Like, they used to have 16 spots at each World Cup, and they're back down to, like, the normal allotment, which is...
Yeah, but if I see who the U.S. has...
They have some alternates in there, too.
We have less... There's less Canadians, like... We only have like 3 or 4 people, but I think for those other ones, we think we have fielded.
It's Michael Vandenham, it's Hugo Brisbois, it's Matt Lelyveld. Oh, he also has a Dutch name. Matt Lelyveld. It's the water, it's the field in the water with all the lely plants. That's a Lelyveld. Okay,
Dutch lesson, I'm ready.
What's the most dangerous plant to stand below?
I don't know what it said.
A water lily, because it will kill you if you stand under it too long.
How? Why? What?
Because you can't breathe in the water. They're floating on the water, and if you stand below them in the water, you will die.
This is a terrible joke.
Did you just make that up, or is that like a...
No, it's alright if you stand below a water lily.
So, you drown.
Okay, so maybe good for the show notes. I don't know if you guys have show notes.
We never have, but it's never too late.
Okay, so I'm originally from Friesland, like the north of the Netherlands, and our flag has the lilies in it. It's like blue and white lines, and in the white lines we have the red lilies. And a lot of people think it's a heart, but it's actually a lily, so it's rounded off on the bottom. And in Friesland it's called a pompeblad.
Pumpa blood.
The land of lilies and cows.
Yeah, basically that, yeah.
Uh-huh. Could be worse.
And below sea level. So Mike is talking me into the BC bike race, but I would love to do that, but depends a bit on the altitude. If it's
right, because you... Well, I mean, I live at 30 meters above sea level, so that's not very high either.
Oh, yeah, no. That counts.
And BC bike race is not that high elevation at all.
Yeah, it's in Penticton. It's like not... I wouldn't even know offhand, but it can't. I don't think it's more than maybe much more than 1,000.
No,
I think maybe the highest parts of the stage are at 1,000.
Yeah.
Its altitude is only... it's all in your head. It's just... it only exists if you believe it.
Well, in some places it exists.
I almost died when I came with a lot of ambition to the U.S. for those mountain bike races, and I did this one in Colorado, and the start was at 1,600 meters, and I was just... I thought I just got a heart attack over there. I was like, hey, why can't I breathe?
Yeah. That was a little bit me this weekend in Canmore. I was just like, if you just can't like surge super hard. You just have to like knock it down a level and just ride more steady.
Yeah, we buried the lead again. Jen won a mountain bike race in Canmore.
Yeah.
Smashing it.
Did you win the short track as well? I didn't actually see the results from that.
No, so I... I got here on Friday, kind of around when they had the short track. When you guys were talking about your driving, I did some epic driving this week as well. I flew into Kamloops on Thursday night, so I got in at like 10, came back to my place, went to sleep, woke up at like 4 or 5 in the morning, just because I was still on Ontario time, built my bike, put it in the car, and drove 7.5-8 hours to Canmore, raced. And then like the race on Sunday coming back, it finished up kind of late. Like we had podium at like 6 in the evening, and then I just drove the 7.5 hours back after that. So, but it wasn't that bad, because I always have bad post-race sleep, so I just took advantage of that. I was like, I wasn't going to sleep after the race anyways, I might as well drive.
Yeah, so. And then you're home. It's always, there's something about waking up at home on Monday, as opposed to like being somewhere else, or waking up where you're going to be for that day. I would way rather, like even on these trips, I would way rather spend, you know, go to bed a little bit later on the Sunday night, yeah. And then you get up on Monday and you're like, okay, I can do things, I can go for a ride, all this stuff.
Yeah, you just get to settle in. The only downside was that I had to go to work on Monday. I like got to work. It was like,
but you're working in a bike shop, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You should work in the Netherlands in a bike shop, because every bike shop is closed on the Monday.
Mm.
You won't find a bike shop that's open on Monday.
Yeah, there you go. Get the weekend. Usually, we're closed on Sundays though. But,
yeah, we're also closed on Sundays and Saturday afternoons.
They just work less in the Netherlands, is what we're getting at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just a Euro thing. It's like the half the week is the weekend.
Not always.
It seems like you always have weird midweek vacation holidays too.
I've tried to get food in Belgium on a Sunday evening after a race, and it's like, good luck.
Oh, yeah. So I live in Germany, and like Saturday afternoon, everything is closed. You won't be able to get anything on a Sunday. Even the ATM's closed.
How? It's a machine.
Yeah, where I live, the ATM's closed.
They're like, ATM needs a break. You can only work 3 hours a week.
Yeah, he's also tired.
Yeah. All right, we should probably wrap things up. We've been talking for a while.
Yeah, you guys got to get out and ride. So what are you doing today? So you guys, today is Tuesday.
Today is a big media day.
Layout the week.
Oh, yeah. So we're doing a few hours on the road this morning after this podcast. Kind of have to, like, we're racing so much in this block that you got to find these little windows to train when you have a chance. Otherwise, it's like, it can be tempting just to rest all the time between the races. And then you end up, you know, 5 weeks into the season and you haven't done a training day.
Yeah.
So we'll ride for what, like three and a half hours today. And then this evening, we're going to this this little bike shop called Sweetwater Bikes, which really conveniently is both a Giant and a Bomb Track dealer.
Yeah.
Who else is a bike company. And they're a Hunt dealer, which is your, which is like kind of a crazy coincidence. It was like it was match made in heaven right here.
Meant to be.
And we're doing a little meet and greet, hanging out, and then
drink some Spa Gold over there.
Yeah? You think that's what it'll be? Or maybe it'll be... I don't know. I hope they have, like, Le Chouf or something.
Yeah, Leffe Blond.
Leffe, yeah. Anyways, some Dutch beer, maybe some coffee, I don't know. Belgian beer, sorry. Oh, we'll drink some Amstel Gold. Not good?
It's, no.
Yeah. Some Heineken?
Yeah, as well.
Okay. We'll drink some Heineken. Be on our way.
Yeah, this is really, like, what Canada has a little bit with Nickelback, it seems. Like, the Netherlands has with Amstel beer.
Right. Like, nobody from the Netherlands likes Amstel beer.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you want to throw a party and you're like, oh, yeah, I don't want to have the party too long, you just get, like, a few boxes of normal beer. And then once you're like, oh, well, let's wrap things up and you have a hard time sending people away, you just, like, get a box of Amstel beer. Like, oh, everybody's like, oh, I think I have to go home again. That's how it works. Yeah, no, serious. Amstel beer is...
Didn't know that.
But didn't you also know, like, that alcohol sponsors are not allowed to sponsor sport events in the Netherlands and Belgium? That's why only the Amstel Gold Race or that Heineken stuff, everything, that only their alcohol-free beer is sponsoring. So it's, like, really big Amstel Gold, and then it has, like, really tiny 0.0 on the bottom sponsoring. That's, like, the loophole in beer sponsoring.
No idea. Yeah. That's funny.
They're not allowed to sponsor with the alcohol.
Do you think these companies make an alcohol-free beer so they can sponsor the events, or do they just sell enough of the alcohol-free beer to make it worthwhile?
I would think the first place, because there's also, like... So, I did this like broker. I showed you the video with Mark Cavendish.
Yeah, yeah.
My most famous reel ever made. And we had a real face off. Like,
yeah, we're influencers now.
Yeah, we're Instagram face offing. But so I did this this criterium, and after they were like, oh yeah, come have some drinks there in Belgium. Yeah, it's good. But I was like, yeah, I still have to drive home. So yeah, can drink one or two beers, but then I want to have the alcohol free beers. And then in Belgium, I come in this bar with like 1 million different kind of beers. Like, oh, can I have an alcohol free beer? And it was yeah, we don't have that.
Makes sense.
So I was like, oh, let me get a cola then.
Makes sense. I've seen the party tents at the Belgian races. There's no alcohol-free beer flowing there.
No, you only, at the race, mainly you can only get like cola,
Jubiler.
Beer. Yeah, yeah. Jubiler. And yeah, that's it. But it's often a thing at those big parties. Or maybe I'm glitching now the whole beer industry. But it has the big Jubiler tanks and big Jubiler tents and everything. But it's not the Jubiler beers. Like the really cheap. It's like the headache beer. Yeah, you can't get a headache of every beer, but it's like the really cheap party beer. It's really bad. But they just have a other name on this page.
It's a conspiracy.
Yeah, because you those tanks are a lot cheaper, and there's a lot more water in it. That's why there's also not so much, like, how do you say, like the foam, the white stuff on the beer.
I can't say I've ever had a Jupiler or a knockoff Jupiler at a Belgian race yet. That should be in my bucket list.
You come down to
go into the party tent, get that woomp woomp
woomp. Oh, dude, yeah. After yeah. If you do Worlds this year,
yeah. Oh
no, oh yeah, it probably won't be here. So if you do Worlds next year, you also have to come to Worlds next year. Then afterwards, just go to the party tent.
That's the best way to do it.
Yeah,
people
yeah.
buy you beer if you race.
Yeah, yeah, they carry you around in the tent. You just have to keep your kit on. Just don't shower, get in there muddy. People put you up your shoulder and carry you around.
After a few fake Jupilers, you don't even remember that you're muddy.
No.
Yeah.
No, that goes pretty quick then. And you don't have to pay for anything as soon as you come there in a racing suit.
Yeah, this is good because part of my plan, someone's trying to make me a supporters club, so maybe Costa's trying to teach me what I need to do for that.
Yeah, yeah, and how to get into that and, like, get your own supporters cafe and, like, organize an Eidfestein.
Yeah, an Eidfestein to make some money. This is my next project. We'll work on, like, maybe next podcast we'll work on Belgian cyclocross economics and partying.
Yeah, how to get things running.
All right.
No, we're freezing. Well, not anymore.
I think with that, maybe we'll our internet connection's kind of falling apart a little bit here, so it might be time to wrap things up. I'm not sure if we'll get to hear from Jen again or not. Yeah, thanks everyone for listening. Episode 15 with Gossa, myself, Jen. See y'all next week.